Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Divided government is one way to say it. Political gridlock is another. And depending on how the elections go tomorrow, businesses might be using yet a different term, uncertainty, and how it plays in the American economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, committed to customer choice and powering America's clean energy future through investments in nuclear, wind, solar, and efficiency technologies. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, today the 1st of November. If you can believe that, it is good to have you here. It's basically all over but the counting for the 2010 midterm election cycle. And when the counts do finally start to come in tomorrow night, corporate America could be looking at a very different picture than it's had the past couple of years. We asked our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale what the economic future might hold if the polls hold true.
Historically, businesses feel more comfortable when government power is split between the parties. That keeps ambitious agendas in check, reducing the cost of complying with new regulations. Bill Schneider is an expert on polling at the Democratic think tank Third Way.
What businesses want is a government that's not too extreme. That means usually that they prefer a divided government.
Like the Republican wave in 1994 that ended 2 years of Democratic control of Washington, the inter-party fireworks even shut down the government for a while. But for all the similarities with 94, this year will be different, says Andy LePerrier with the ISI Group.
It's one thing to have stalemate when we're having a booming economy like we did in the 1990s. It's another thing to have stalemate when the unemployment rate is 9.5% and you're looking for different policy measures that might help improve the economy.
This time around, LePerrier says gridlock will create a lot of uncertainty for business people who want to create jobs and reduce the deficit.
A lot of business people would like to see both of those things. If you get gridlock, you may get neither.
The worst of all worlds, he says, for companies that want decisions on tax cuts, health care, and financial regulations. Larry Burton at the Business Roundtable says businesses can't afford an inactive government now.
What is best for businesses when elected representatives bring an energy and commitment to Washington to tackle the big issues impacting the economy and jobs?
Which means divided government is less likely to shield businesses from political uncertainty this time around. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Whichever way the elections do turn out tomorrow, there is at least one point of economic agreement between businesses and the White House. Both the financial industry and the Obama administration want to move past the current mortgage paperwork mess. They want to get all those home foreclosures out of the system. The housing market has been stuck the past couple of weeks because banks cut corners with their foreclosure filings. And foreclosure sales have stalled because nobody is sure who owns what. Today, Fitch Ratings reported that because of the voluntary suspensions banks have imposed to review bad paperwork, banks could be taking 3 to 6 months longer than normal to sell distressed homes. The White House wants foreclosures taken care of on the theory that that'll help the wider economy recover. But why do banks want to move so fast on foreclosures? Marketplace's Jennifer Collins has the answers.
First, no bank wants to be a landlord, especially when it's taking over the ownership of a distressed home. Brian Battle follows banks for Performance Trust Capital Partners.
If you live in a house and you're not paying on it, you're not going to fix the gutters. So that all those expenses build up.
And the bank has to fix those gutters and pay the property taxes, not to mention legal fees. Rick Sharga of RealtyTrack says that can cost $1,000 a day.
It's actually much more expensive in a lot of cases for a bank to own a property than it is for the average homeowner.
And when houses aren't selling, no one knows how much they'll be worth. Jack DeGann of Harbor Advisory says that means uncertainty for the banks.
they don't want assets they're not used to dealing with and have a difficult time valuing. And real estate is both.
With nearly a year's backlog of unsold homes, adding hundreds of thousands of foreclosed homes to the market may not seem like it's in the bank's best interest. Even so, Brian Battle says the bank's strategy is to
sell it as fast as possible because it seems like housing is a declining market. So you'd rather sell it today than a year from now when prices are generally declining.
Fitch Ratings expects home prices to decline another 10% over the next 2 years, but the damage could be worse depending on how quickly foreclosures are sold. RealtyTrack expects new foreclosures to stay high through next year. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
As long as we're on foreclosures, we told you Friday about a Miami-area bank that failed after it offered too many adjustable-rate mortgages. Bank United was taken over by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation last spring. Then the FDIC sold Bank United to a private equity group, and they have now decided to take it public. And it could turn out to be a pretty good deal. Some new documents filed with the SEC include revealing nuggets about just how good a deal those private equity investors got from the FDIC and how prospective shareholders might win out as well. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports.
When a bank dies, it can take an expert to parse the meaning snuck into deal terms, like the one private investors got for Bank United. Its government filings state the bank's covered loans and real estate were purchased for 76.5% of their value.
Translate that into English. There was not a huge amount of downside risk here. You know, Bank United paid pennies on the dollar for the assets that they bought.
That's Christopher Whalen with Institutional Risk Analytics. He says dead bank deals have to be attractive to entice investors and get the bank assets back into private hands. And attractive terms may be what will lure new investors to Bank United's proposed public offering, especially the loss-sharing agreement the bank brokered with the government. Those assets it bought for 76 cents on the dollar, the bank says it'll earn 90 cents on the dollar even if they all go bad. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation agreed to cover 80% of Bank United's losses on mortgage loans, up to $4 billion. Any higher than that, and the government assumes even more of the loss. So far, it's reimbursed Bank United some $860 million. Miami-based bank consultant Ken Thomas says the deal motivates the bank to foreclose.
So when a problem loan occurs, they don't call you up and try to work it out. They call their lawyers, throw it into foreclosure, because they want to meet the minimum. Once they meet that level, the 80% coverage goes to 95% coverage.
The FDIC also gets a cut from Bank United's turnaround. The deal guarantees the government a minimum take of $25 million when it goes public. Not much compared to the bank's profit in the first half of this year, but better than nothing. With so much upside for investors, Bank United's IPO is likely to attract a crowd. In New York, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
The big Wall Street story of this Monday isn't going to come until tomorrow. There are reports this afternoon. GM is set to file for its IPO in the morning. In the markets today, big swings early, and then they finished flat. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Kardashian sisters, Kim, Khloe, and Kourtney, are part of that growing part of celebrity America that is famous mostly for being famous. They've built a sisterly empire of reality TV shows, fashion lines, perfumes, cosmetics, even their own diet pills. Next week, they're going to add financial services to the mix, a prepaid MasterCard debit card with their likenesses on the plastic. Of course, having a Kardashian card doesn't mean you can spend like a Kardashian, but Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports the sisters are joining a celebrity trend.
It wasn't your typical financial product launch. Here's how the Kardashian sisters pitched their new plastic on their blogs.
Woohoo! How cool is this? Kourt, Kim, and I have teamed up with Mobile Resource Card to launch our very own customized Kardashian prepaid MasterCard.
A couple of weeks ago, rapper Lil Wayne unveiled plans for a similar card. Ron Shevlin is a banking products analyst with the Aite Group. He says young consumers are a great market for these cards.
They are not great candidates for credit cards, and they're not particularly fond of writing checks, so they much prefer to use debit cards,
which they can load and reload with cash. Card issuers like them, too. prepaid cards aren't subject to some of the strict credit card regulations that limit fees. And the cards are being used more and more like an alternative to bank accounts. David Robertson publishes the Nilson Report.
These prepaid accounts are starting to look like more traditional checking accounts. And that's certainly where the entire prepaid card industry is headed.
The prepaid debit card industry is worth more than $120 billion. Nearly 12 million people are expected to have one by 2014. Analyst Ron Shevlin says prepaid debit cards don't bring in the big bucks credit cards did, but they do generate fees and get the kind of buzz your run-of-the-mill platinum card just won't.
I actually did a Google search on Kardashian debit card, and it already has 3.8 million hits on Google.
Now that is priceless. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Shopping for clothes is not anywhere on my list of favorite things to do. In my defense, I will say that the fashion trends of the past half decade or so haven't really been me. More suited to a younger, skinnier hipster type. Narrow-cut shirts and sweaters, skinny jeans, anybody? But I'm relieved to say that some of the clothes out there now are something that regular men can, quite literally, get into. We've called Kate Betts to talk about the turn in men's fashion. She's a contributor to both Time and to The Daily Beast. Kate, good to talk to you again.
Thank you for having me.
So I have the J. Crew catalog up on the computer here in the studio, flipping through it a little bit, and I did a little research last night before we talked. Can't help
doing some shopping?
No, actually, because I'm not a big shopper, but we can talk about that later. But I can't help but notice it's a little more, how should you say, manly, I suppose, right? You got flannel, you got leather jackets, you got big boots. What's going on?
Well, there are a few things going on here, and J. Crew is certainly spearheading this whole movement, but there is a kind of more rugged man coming back into fashion. You see it in what they call the new heritage brands that people like J. Crew, retailers like J. Crew are partnering with. And you even see it on the runways of Milan and, you know, runways like Gucci and Jill Sander showing these chunky fisherman sweaters. And even the models are much more beefy and kind of American looking, as opposed to this sexual ambiguity we've seen in the past few seasons of these very young, skinny models.
You said new heritage. Expand on that a little bit. What does that mean?
Well, it's funny. There are all these great American brands that are coming back, like Stetson, like Pendleton, Levi's, Alden Shoes. L.L. Bean is even doing a special line with this young, trendy designer based in Portland, Maine.
All right, those are two words you've never heard together before, right? L.L. Bean and young and trendy?
Right, exactly.
So I had somebody actually, for the first time in my life, call me a metrosexual yesterday. I forget what was going on. But if you know me, you know I'm about the farthest you can get from that. But that whole metrosexual concept, I mean, is that sort of dead now with the rugged man being back?
I actually think it is. I think that the metrosexual was much more of a kind of urban idea, and this is probably less of an urban idea. And maybe it's just the fantasy of escaping the whole, you know, nervous job market that sort of paralyzes urban centers.
Or maybe I have actually become a metrosexual and I don't even know it. I mean, there, you know, there's
yeah, and
that.
You're just a little bit behind
the trend. I'm a little bit late. That's right. Lovely. Thank you for that. So there's a meta aspect to this whole thing too, which is that the shift to the rugged male and rugged fashion is taking place in the context of a down economy. Are those two linked, do you think?
I think they are linked. I think that there is also a very strong aspect of this is people wanting to buy American brands and buy things that are made in America. I think a lot of people feel a little bit alienated by all this talk about, you know, workforces being outsourced and everything being made in China. And, you know, people want to make things again and make the economy work. And so I think that's also in the back of the mind when people are talking about American brands and this whole new heritage idea. I also think it's a reaction to the overspending because a lot of this stuff is not that expensive.
So how long is this trend going to last, do you think? I mean, can I buy my wardrobe now and have it last for 10 years, or am I going to have to change something out in like 18 months?
Well, I think all trends, you know, it's all cyclical, but I do think that there is a classical kind of look that you can keep for a long time. So I think it's pretty safe to say that you can invest in this look.
I will do that. Kate Betts, she contributes to Time and the Daily Beast. Kate, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You can get a taste of the trends in men's fashion and see what I might wear if shopping were my thing. Producers made me do it. It's on our website, marketplace.org. Coming up, the professional loneliness of long-haul truckers.
With the traffic and the cars cutting you off and just the crazy people out there on the road, there's a way to kind of blow off steam.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials edged 6 points higher today. That's just a tiny fraction of 1%, finished at 11,124. The NASDAQ shaved off 2 points, a tenth percent, closed at 2504. The broader S&P 500 nudged up a single point, nearly a tenth of 1% on that particular index, wrapped up trading at 1,184. Several financial stocks reversed an early rally on news that the government is probing J.P. Morgan Chase, that for possible improper dealings in subprime mortgage securities. Shares in Chase, Wells Fargo, and Citigroup all slipped a half percent. Morgan Stanley lagged 0.75%. Bond insurance firm Ambac Financial took a big hit after the company announced its negotiating plans for a prepackaged Chapter 11 bankruptcy filing. The already lagging stock plunged another 50% today. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By Microsoft, providing comprehensive business solutions for the cloud. You can learn more at Microsoft.com/cloud. And by Vanguard, whose mission is to simplify investing and to help people reach their financial goals at Vanguard.com/public radio. Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve meets to discuss interest rates and the economy. Americans go to the polls. California puts recreational use of marijuana to a vote. And party on the ISS. Human beings have been living on the International Space Station for 10 years. It has more living space than a conventional five-bedroom house. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. We don't do maternity leave in this country the same way a lot of other countries do. First of all, we don't even officially call it maternity leave. We call it family and medical leave. Lasts 12 weeks. And second of all, you don't get paid for it. There are some states that do have paid parental leave, but there is no federal law here that requires paid time off. In Canada, women are entitled to as much as a year for maternity leave. They call it mat leave up there. Canadian women do get some pay while they're out, and employers generally set their jobs aside for them. Emphasis on the generally part. Marketplace's Sean Cole has more.
In April 2006, Lisa Dillon started working at an energy and gas company outside Toronto. She didn't want us to say which one because they're still in a nasty legal dispute.
I was formerly a sales specialist and then quickly was promoted to regional sales manager. Then I got pregnant.
In the beginning of 08. She planned a year-long maternity leave starting that fall. Now, in Ontario, there's something called the Employment Standards Act. It says an employer has to reinstate someone after mat leave to the same job or a comparable one unless, and this is the sticking point, the reason for termination has nothing to do with the leave. So Lisa's boss brings in a temp, tells Lisa to train her.
And I might have done an awesome job, too awesome of a job, I guess, because she is still there and I'm not. But anyways.
Lisa has her baby, and 11 months into the leave, her boss calls.
And did a termination phone call. Didn't even do it in person.
They said her job didn't exist anymore. Part of it had moved to Illinois. Meanwhile, the company was expanding into new markets and had hired her temp full time.
I was shocked. I quickly went to Google, and I came across my lawyer.
Named?
Daniel Lublin.
Of Witten and Lublin in Toronto. He's an employment lawyer, and he says he sees cases like this all the time. That sticking point, the nothing to do with the leave part, he says it's effectively a loophole for employers.
It's too easy for them to create the appearance that a job doesn't exist when essentially that job has been unbundled and repackaged and redistributed to other employees. In other words, the department didn't shut down and the job exists maybe not in name but in form.
And maybe the company likes the temp better than the woman on leave, which is what Lisa Dillon suspects.
I could have done my manager's job, no problem.
You were a threatening presence.
I was a threatening presence.
I feel just scared right now.
Yeah, I know.
But I find a lot of times it's the out of sight, out of mind approach. You know, companies have had to make cutbacks, especially over the last few years, and it's easiest to get rid of the person who's not there.
Lublin says he's seen a surge in these cases over the last few years due to the recession. So naturally, a lawyer for the employer side would have seen the same thing, right?
No, and I've heard that ad hoc impression previously.
Kristen Taylor is a partner with the firm Fraser Milner Casgrain. She represents employers of all stripes, manufacturing, finance, and wrongful dismissal claims are part of the gig. But that nothing to do with the leave loophole?
I don't think this is a loophole in the statute. I think this is the statute recognizing that you're entitled to the same treatment. You're not entitled to better treatment because you're on the leave. When that person is effective along with all of their peers around them, well, they shouldn't have a greater right, right? They should have the same right.
And yet she says women can get preferential treatment under the statute, sometimes unknowingly. She's had clients who were about to lay someone off, found out that person was pregnant, and then spared her.
Because nobody wants to be that employer.
In one case, she says, a client broke the bad news to an employee who responded, "You can't fire me, I'm pregnant." The client didn't know that. Still, the employee took the case to the Ministry of Labor. The adjudicator wanted hard evidence that the firing decision had been in the works for a while.
An email trail or a paper trail. It had to be written because they weren't just going to take their word for it.
I can tell how you feel about this by how you're telling the story.
Sorry, yeah. It was a little bit frustrating, shall we say.
The employee won and got a settlement. That's the thing. Once an official complaint is filed, the process is very employee-friendly. And by that time, the job itself isn't always the issue anymore.
A lot of times the women are coming to me and saying, you know what, Daniel?
Daniel Lublin.
I'm so mad, I don't want to go back, is what I'll hear a lot of times. I don't want to be reinstated. So what can you do for me? And at that point, we're looking at compensation.
Which is the case with his client, Lisa Dillon. Sort of.
I mean, it is about the money, but it's not about the money. I went to Daniel and I said, you know what, Daniel, this is just a matter of principle with me. I don't want them to do this to anyone else again.
So far, Lisa's been through two settlement hearings, an appeal from the company, and there's a third hearing this coming January, after which she hopes her point will be made. She is working again, not for her old company, for a competitor. In Toronto, I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace.
There's always been a certain romance to the open road. In life, generally, to be sure, but professionally sometimes as well. Long-haul truckers don't have to worry about the guy in the next cubicle talking on the phone too loud. There's nobody stealing your lunch out of the office fridge. You are out there all by yourself. But the peace and quiet comes at a price once loneliness sets in, especially for truckers with a gregarious streak in them. Julie Rose reports now from WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina.
People told Terry Martindale she was too short to be a trucker.
4'11 3/4 inches.
Turns out the seat in her truck moves way forward, so her height isn't a problem. But her personality kind of is.
I'm really outgoing. I'm really friendly. I'm bubbly. I have something to say to everybody.
Which isn't easy to do when you drive 11 hours a day for days on end. And that's how she ended up on YouTube.
Oh, sweet! I got parking!
This was her first YouTube video back in 2008, a 10-minute day-in-the-life montage. Endless road signs and trees flash by. There's the occasional traffic jam. Martindale talks to the webcam like it's a passenger.
It's time for a little truck at a Goobie.
More than 4,000 people have watched that video, which doesn't sound like much in the YouTube universe.
But you can see from the comment thread why YouTube has become such an important part of Martindale's life. It's all inside jokes and, hey, where are you headed this week, conversations. Some have migrated to phone and face-to-face meetings. This is the professional network Martindale longed for during the first 8 years of her trucking career.
YouTube's definitely a gateway. It's worked for me.
She's kind of giggling there because she actually just started dating another YouTube trucker.
Hey, everybody.
This guy, Jeff Banner.
Just got onto my YouTube page here and found I had 1,008 subscribers, which is totally awesome. And
there are hundreds of truckers on YouTube. Most are part diary, part music video. You see lots of messy-haired drivers rolling out of bed in a truck cab, shuffling into a gas station to take a shower. North Carolina driver Rob Wilson lies awake at night, conjuring ideas for his next video.
Oh, there she is.
Or am I on YouTube? Hello?
Yeah.
Even getting interviewed about making YouTube videos is an excuse to roll the camera.
It's part of what makes me sane, with the traffic and the cars cutting you off and just the crazy people out there on the road. There's a way to kind of blow off steam.
Some trucking companies have banned their drivers from making videos out of concern for liability. But the most prolific YouTube truckers have been embraced as ambassadors for the industry.
This is Bobby Buffet. How y'all doing out there today?
Trucker Jim McCarter's videos feature his goofy alter ego, Bobby Buffet, and draw tens of thousands of views. That's enough to even earn him a little extra cash. YouTube made him an advertising partner and pays him a penny per click.
Let's say 60,000, you know, hits on a video. What's that, $6,600 maybe? I'm not going to retire or nothing on that. And I don't really do it for the money either. Being able to share this with everybody really brought more job satisfaction to me.
There are a few YouTube truckers making enough on videos they could actually quit driving. Trouble is that money dries up unless they've got their wheels and cameras rolling. In North Carolina, I'm Julie Rose for Marketplace.
You can see some of those videos and maybe help a trucker out, too, on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by MassMutual, with financial professionals nationwide who are trained to serve the unique financial needs of their clients at massmutual.com. By the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org. And by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
A final note this afternoon, another icon of American journalism is going under. The publisher of the National Enquirer announced today it's going to file for Chapter 11 sometime in the next couple of weeks. American Media Incorporated, proud owner of Star Magazine as well as Men's Fitness and Shape, has been having a tough time competing in the cutthroat business of covering celebrities, going up against People and TMZ and Us Weekly, to name just three. Thought that was a fitting close to a day that saw the Kardashian sisters mentioned on this broadcast for the first time, don't you think? And on that note, that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Monday. Today, the Dow tacked on 6 points. That is a tiny fraction of 1%. The NASDAQ slipped 2 points, about a tenth percent. The S&P 500 notched up 1 point, almost a tenth of 1%. Our producers include Avishai Artsy, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this broadcast, the president's not even on the ballot tomorrow, but how much does he really matter anyway?
People think the president is almost like a benevolent despot. The president is really just someone who's sitting in the co-pilot seat in a plane that's already on autopilot.
Another installment of Freakonomics Radio tomorrow. I'm Kai Ruzdahl. Do hope you can join us for that.
American Public Media.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.